I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met yesterday with King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia to get more information about the disappearance and likely death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It's been 2 weeks since Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Turkey and has not been seen since. President Trump tweeted that the Saudi prince, quote, totally denied any knowledge of what took place in their Turkish consulate. Pompeo said the Saudis promised a thorough, timely, and transparent investigation. He's in Turkey now, where Turkish officials claim Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered by Saudis, possibly linked to the security services. U.S. lawmakers are calling for a halt of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, for the imposition of sanctions, and a new relationship with the kingdom. Well, today we want to take a look at the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which dates back to the 1930s, and of course, what the future holds. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Anna Vyden. She is program coordinator with the University of Pennsylvania's Middle East Center. Anna Vyden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Of course, many things are happening behind the scenes, but I was looking at the photo op of a smiling Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, in conversation with the Crown Prince. The Crown Prince says, "We are strong and old allies. We face our challenges together, the past, the day of tomorrow." Pompeo says, "Absolutely." Are we at a crisis point with Saudi Arabia?
I think it's safe to say that this is the crisis point between the two allies, longstanding allies, more than 70 years. There are different things going on. Of course, the Trump administration and the Saudi regime wants to kind of say that this is nothing serious. But what is starting to happening is that this is starting to damaging the relationship, starting to damage Saudi Arabia's image in Congress, for example. And what we have heard more specifically is these talks of arms deals being kind of tainted by this affair.
And I do want to pick up on that, but we're learning more and more. And of course, there are things that we do not know, and I certainly don't know, but more and more reports coming out that the men that flew into Turkey more than two weeks ago seem to have ties to the Crown Prince himself, part of their security detail or his security detail.
Yeah, that's what has been reported. As of today, we cannot establish that to be the fact, but it seems more and more likely that this is the case.
And how much of a threat then was Khashoggi to the Saudi regime? I mean, he, Saudi-born, seemed to have a lot of connections to the Saudi government, served in Saudi embassies, became a critic in the last couple of years. But how has he been viewed?
I think that this particular regime is one of the least kind of liberal, if we can talk about liberal, in Saudi terms. And I think that someone like Khashoggi, who definitely has been an establishment figure for many, many years, he worked in different embassies, Saudi embassies, and he's been having other functions as well, and real close ties to the royal family. It's hard to actually know what kind of threat he posed, but this regime seems to be very much afraid of these types of criticisms.
There's no way to answer this, but one wonders, you know, more than 2 weeks ago, why he felt, he meaning Jamal Khashoggi, felt safe enough to enter the Saudi consulate in Turkey. He was looking to get married, so he needed some paperwork, went in by himself.
I think that is a testament to the kind of impropriety of this story, that he actually felt safe enough to go into the Saudi consulate. And he probably thought about his ties to, or old ties to the regime.
Thinking he would be safe.
Yes, that is my conclusion.
Well, he's clearly disappeared because we haven't heard from him.
We
do not know where he is. There are more and more serious reports that he was murdered, maybe even dismembered. Why do you think would the kingdom risk the kind of condemnation that has come their way?
I think there's a certain amount of hubris now in the Saudi regime. Ever since King Salman came to power, we see a very aggressive, much more assertive foreign policy, and also a more repressive policy, domestic policy. So I don't think this is not something. I mean, it is a very blunt thing that has happened, but I don't think that we should be surprised. This is something that progressively has led up to this type of event.
It seems that when the Crown Prince took whatever power he has or mm-hmm. appropriated that kind of power, some more women were allowed to drive. And I think that was hailed as this wonderful progressive breakthrough. But other things happened that really undermined that.
I think this is something for us, window dressing in a way. I mean, of course, individually for Saudi women, something important has happened. There is also something we can see in universities, in workplaces in Saudi Arabia, less gender segregation. So this is something that we have to say that is very positive. But at the same time, human rights abuses, these types of events, I think that this is not something strange if we look into Saudi Arabia as such.
I want to play a couple of clips, one from Senator Lindsey Graham. He was on Fox and Friends on Tuesday talking about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is often referred to as MBS. Let's give it a listen.
I'm not going back to Saudi Arabia as long as this guy's in charge.
So you're telling the Crown Prince has to leave?
It's up to them, but I'm not going back. I've been their biggest defender on the floor of the United States Senate. This guy is a wrecking ball. He had this guy murdered in a consulate in Turkey, and to expect me to ignore it, I feel used and abused. I was on the floor every time defending Saudi Arabia because there's a good ally. There's a difference between a country and an individual. The right. MBS figure is, to me, toxic. He can never be a world leader on the world stage.
Do you think that too many Americans were snowed by Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince?
I think there is some truth to that. I mean, here comes a young guy, someone who is in his early 30s, proposing a complete makeover of Saudi Arabia's institutions, economic, not political, but and some social, proposing to not rely anymore on oil or to the extent. He's proposing things that people have been longing for a very long time, been talking about ever since the 1970s. And here comes someone who is doing this and seemed to be shoring up power. It's something that seems to be very positive. But what is happening is that at the same time in Saudi Arabia, the old-style consensual type of policies do not really take place anymore. And in the past, this has created a stability in Saudi Arabia. So now we have a situation where an individual is holding an enormous amount of power in his hands.
Is he the most powerful person in Saudi Arabia now?
Absolutely, absolutely. Without a doubt.
Let me play one more clip, and then I do want to go back several decades to the beginning of U.S.-Saudi relations. This is Senator Marco Rubio of Florida talking with CNN's Jake Tapper on Sunday's State of the Union.
I believe the Trump administration will do something. The president has said that. But if he doesn't, Congress will. That I can tell you with 100% certainty. With almost full unanimity across the board, Republicans and Democrats, there will be a very strong congressional response if, in fact, the Saudis lured him into that consulate, murdered him, cut up his body, and disposed of it. There is going to be a very strong congressional response.
So time will tell, yes?
Time will tell, but I think we shouldn't be fooled by this. I mean, for the longest time, Congress have been kind of had issues with Saudi Arabia, but there has been a certain narrative that has been driven down. It has been successful so far about the Saudi Arabia being something that we need this ally.
Well, let's go back, and let's go back to the beginning of this relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. 1930s, is that a good place to start?
It's a good place to start. In 1993, this concession was being attributed to what was to become Aramco by the Saudi king in competition with other companies and with the British, with the Brits, and the U.S. Company got it.
And this is Aramco stands for America.
Saudi Arabian Oil Company.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. It began with a business relationship over oil.
A business relationship over oil. And it's not until the 1940s, early 1940s, that we have more kind of state-to-state relations. I mean, we also have to remember that Saudi Arabia is a very young country, 1932 only.
Is when it actually began,
yes.
Became
a
country.
And it was created through conquest by Ibn Saud. So it's a country that has taken an enormous leap in terms of development. I mean, physical development, if not maybe political development.
I mean, obviously because of oil wealth.
Because of oil wealth, yes.
Been able to create this,
right.
This kingdom.
Yes.
It seems, though, when you look back over U.S.-Saudi relations, that it has been very transactional. And I say that because we're talking about an ultra-conservative Islamic absolute monarchy when we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the United States, which is obviously a much more secular, it's a constitutional republic.
Yeah, this is also what prompted me to study this relationship in the beginning, a fascination with trying to understand how this unlikely relationship came to be and came to be so long-standing and successful and strong. And as you point out, this is a very transactional relationship. I often tend to think about the Israel-American relationship and to compare the two. And here we have a relationship that has no sentimental ties whatsoever. It's purely pragmatic from both sides. Of course, there are individual friendships that have been created, but we have nothing as sentimentally kind of strong as the American-Israeli relationship.
Almost up on a break here, but if we're talking about a transactional relationship, is it oil and arms? I mean, is that essentially what this relationship has been about?
I would say that it is about what oil can buy. And in the beginning, the U.S. also acted as a development kind of agent to Saudi Arabia, provided a lot of logistical, scientific, economic support, military logistic support to Saudi Arabia. And of course, this created this very interdependent relationship, economic, close economic ties with, as we have moved forward in throughout history, very important defense ties.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Anna Vyden, she's program coordinator at the University of Pennsylvania's Middle East Center. And we are talking about the longstanding relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. Much more to talk about through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to today. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Again, we are talking about U.S.-Saudi relations, and it should be said that both Republican and Democratic presidents over the decades have forged a very close relationship with the kingdom, often built around oil and arms sales. We are talking about the beginning of this relationship, and we'll be talking a bit more about the oil crisis of 1973, the Gulf War, of course, 9/11, and where things stand today. Anna Vyden with us, a program coordinator for the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. We've got lots of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I'll get to those comments in just a couple of minutes. Tell us, though, about the significance of the oil crisis in 1973, how that affected U.S.-Saudi relations.
So the 1973 oil crisis is the first moment where I would say the American-Israeli ties causes problems to the Saudi-American relation. And here the Saudi government, the Saudi regime, has to do something, and it has been actually warning the U.S. for a longer period of time that if the policy doesn't change towards Israel, Saudi Arabia will use its oil power. But up to that moment, nobody thought that would ever materialize. So here we have the Saudi king and Egypt that will forge a kind of partnership to impose an oil embargo on the U.S.
I remember it well. I remember, you know, sitting in line for what felt like hours in some cases, certainly many, many minutes waiting to fill up.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting to study this time. If we talk about images, we can see images of Saudis that look like images from the 1930s in Germany of youths with very big noses and so it's an interesting time period. This is the first time we really see these types of reactions when it comes to the U.S.-Saudi relationship. It has been very much saved from those types of reactions.
Well, while there was maybe a blip in that relationship, we certainly have forged strong ties with Saudi Arabia. I'm thinking of the Gulf War, for instance.
Right. I do think that it's important if we talk a little bit more about the 1973 oil embargo, to realize that what actually happened afterwards made this relationship so much stronger. Very many defense agreements, economic agreements were forged between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. And this was the start of this more militarization of Saudi Arabia. This was a way to lock down Saudi Arabia and to prevent Saudi Arabia from reusing the oil threat again. So by making Saudi Arabia also invested in the U.S. economy, it was believed that this would help. And I think it's fair to say that this has been the case.
Well, and certainly the United States' dependence at that time on oil just to keep our economy going. Things are different today, but nonetheless, I'm sure that helped to forge this relationship.
Absolutely, of course. And the general oil energy crisis that was taking place and which was being aggravated by the oil embargo. And a lot of times we conflate the two, but it's important to realize that there was an energy crisis taking place worldwide, and this oil embargo worsened it. And caused economic issues all over the world.
Let's talk about the Gulf War.
Yes.
Which in many ways had to do with oil. Iraq was essentially stealing oil from Kuwait.
Yeah. I tend to think about the Gulf War as a turning point, really, in the U.S.-Saudi relations for many reasons. It was a very, very costly war. It was a war that Saudi Arabia almost had to foot it itself. So that was
paid for.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the deal, and it put Saudi Arabia in an enormously difficult position economically that it took very, very long time to recover from. And this is something that is not very much discussed.
And it cost them a lot of money.
To pay for the war, essentially. And it came to an enormous cost for Saudi Arabia because it was perceived as the infidels being in the Holy Land by very many Saudis.
And the infidels being the United States.
The infidels being the United States, yes. So there was a lot of public opinion against this in Saudi Arabia and also in other Muslim countries.
Well, I'm thinking about Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And of course, that gets us to, which is an extreme form of Islam,
right,
preaching against the West, including mm-hmm. the United States. Thinking also about September 11th, mm-hmm. when we know that most of the terrorist hijackers were from Saudi Arabia.
Yes, but so in between, though, there are a lot of things that have taken place that we need to kind of mention, and that is, for example, the 1979 kind of invasion by the Soviets in Afghanistan, and the war that kind of ensued, and the support that Saudi Arabia, the U.S., Pakistan were giving to the Mujahideen, fundamentalist movements. And this, in turn, kind of spawned what was to become Al-Qaeda. It's very, very complicated.
But
it is complicated. But if we talk about 9/11, we cannot not talk about the war in Afghanistan and also the first Gulf War, because this very much angered Bin Laden, who was to become the creator of Al-Qaeda.
Well, as you mentioned, there are many tentacles,
but
enough time.
Not enough time.
Let me put in a couple of other things, and then I do want to get to some of our comments here. But you do see the investment of Saudi Arabia in the United States, whether it comes to lobbying or funding think tanks, all of that. I mean, is that the Saudi Arabian government trying to influence U.S. policy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, I mean, here again, we can talk about what is often referred to as the Israeli lobby. And if we compare the Arab lobby and we have very much bipartisan support, I mean, for defense deals with Saudi Arabia. And it's the bipartisan support that has kind of helped Saudi Arabia to remain an ally.
Coming from both Republicans and Democrats, whether in Congress or in the White House. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Anna Vyden. She's program coordinator of the University of Pennsylvania's Middle East Center, joining us on Radio Times, this portion of Radio Times, talking about U.S.-Saudi relations, of course, under a microscope because of a journalist who has frankly disappeared and is the subject of much consternation and debate. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Chris says, no one has bothered to mention that Turkey is a member of NATO. Trump picking Saudi Arabia over a NATO ally makes things even worse. And we should add to that that the first foreign trip that President Trump took was to Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
And we know that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, has worked very hard to curry favor with the Crown Prince.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's very true. And I think it's very telling. If we look at the last administration, President Obama, was the first U.S. president ever to openly criticize the Saudi regime. And he did so in an interview with Goldberg in the Atlantic.
In the Atlantic.
It was a very interesting article. And so Saudi Arabia had a lot of issues with the Obama administration. They were hoping for a Trump administration, and they got it.
Let me read some more comments. One from Glenn. Our relationship with Saudi Arabia has always been transactional, oil and arms, as we were mentioning, giving the president's relationship with Putin and Russia's untapped oil reserves with stopping us from shifting that relationship to Russia. That is my fear. And, of course, there's a lot of complicated oil politics.
Right.
The United States is pretty much independent when it comes to fuel and oil because of shale and all of that. But nonetheless, how do you see that?
What is problematic here is that Saudi Arabia still, even if the U.S. no longer is relying to the same extent on Saudi oil, Saudi Arabia still has a lot of leverage over oil policy and can drive up the prices, like cutting production, or drive down the prices by accelerating production. So this, in turn, affects U.S. oil industry. So the U.S. still has to count with Saudi Arabia, and we're still also importing some oil from Saudi Arabia.
Indeed. What do you think, though, and we heard from a couple of members of the U.S. Senate about what needs to be done. It's sort of unclear at this point what would be effective. But as you look at U.S.-Saudi relations, and if it turns out that Khashoggi was murdered and maybe even dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, what should the U.S. do?
I think that the U.S. should really try to limit and affect the defense deals with Saudi Arabia. I think also there's a slight misunderstanding that there has been a lot of defense deals established or forged between Saudi Arabia and the Trump administration. The Saudis has not followed through of many of these deals. So that's something to remember. So what we're talking about now is already established defense deal. For example, those that were forged during the Obama administration, $110 billion, which is not insignificant. So there is still some leverage here. Saudi Arabia is still waging a war in Yemen and needs U.S. support to do so.
Well, and this would be with the I guess the rise of Mohammed bin Salman. He has jailed members of the royal family. He detained the Lebanese prime minister,
yes.
I think, tried to force a resignation, started a fight with Qatar. You mentioned the war in Yemen, which is an extremely disturbing humanitarian crisis there.
Yeah, the biggest.
The biggest so far.
Yeah.
And we did a show about it. It's just absolutely horrifying, jailing critics and dissidents. I mean, is this Saudi Arabia today?
I think this is Saudi Arabia today, but it's much more complex than that, because in Saudi Arabia itself, there are a lot of positive things going on economically and socially too. So we have to remember that. But if we're talking about Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, and if we're talking about the jailing of journalists in Saudi Arabia, the jailing of dissidents or people who are perceived to be dissidents, killing and jailing of these people, yes, that's also right. Saudi Arabia today. So it's an extremely complicated thing to deal with. But I think that what is deeply profoundly problematic is that the Trump administration does not react.
To that part of the...
No, and also things such as international events that would really call for action and angry declarations.
Mm. Well, President Trump tweeted, I believe this was yesterday, spoke with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, totally denied any knowledge of what took place in their Turkish consulate. He was with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during the call, told me he's already started and will rapidly expand a full and complete investigation into this matter. Answers will be forthcoming shortly. That's a tweet from President Trump yesterday. Does that give you confidence?
No, certainly not. It's we're looking at someone who is a business leader, who is now the U.S. president, and who is acting more as a business leader than a diplomat or a leader of a country. And I find that it's deeply problematic. But that's the reality, unfortunately.
And that's Anna Biden. I'm Marty Moscowen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read some more comments. A tweet, women can drive in Saudi Arabia now, but they still have to be accompanied by a man chaperone in the front seat. Is that true? And I should say to our listeners that you grew up in part in Saudi mm-hmm. Arabia. Your father was a dentist there. Mm-hmm. So you were there as what, a teenager?
I was 14, 15 when I was there.
Okay. So you have some sense about, at least back then, what it was like to live there. For women in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's complicated, and it is true that women can drive today, and that is a big accomplishment. But if you talk about with a lot of Saudi women, though, yes, this custodianship that this listener was referring to is still there, right. And it prevents, a woman from living her life freely if she wants to go to the dentist or the doctor, having an appointment. Her husband or guardian needs to give the permission. If you want to travel, if you want to go to work, it's also something that you need permission to do. And, and one thing that I come to think about, which is very important here, is that a lot of women simply do not have the means to hire a driver to go to work. So we're looking at a situation where we have high middle-class women superior classes that this new kind of evolving Saudi Arabia is true for. But for a lot of women, it's not a reality because they simply cannot benefit from this new, more... liberalized economy.
Is there anything you think the United States can do to deal with what could, I think, aptly be described as a kind of, if not humanitarian crisis within Saudi Arabia, but the fact that you've got people who... Women largely are second-class citizens.
Well, truth to be told, I mean, for the longest time, issues such as these have not been deemed sufficiently important to really, really deal with the U.S.-Saudi relationship, not during the Obama administration either. So things have to radically change in Congress and elsewhere. There has to be a desire to really drive down these issues.
Mm. Does Saudi Arabia need the United States more than the United States needs Saudi Arabia today?
I think that is true. I mean, at the same time, though, Saudi Arabia is the biggest defense buyer
from the United States.
Yes, from the United States. So that's something that still has a large impact, and the lobbying from the defense industry. I have attended several conferences where I've heard people from the energy establishment, from the defense establishment, lobby very, very strongly in favor of Saudi Arabia. So we have very kind of vocal voices in favor of Saudi Arabia.
It's not impossible, but it's hard to imagine the disentangling then of these two countries.
This might be a case, if this turns out to be true, even the Trump administration cannot address this issue.
I mean, you feel confident about that if it turns out Khashoggi was murdered and maybe more inside of the consulate?
I think that Congress will make that clear to the Trump administration that this is something that has to be addressed, yes.
Well, Anna Vieden, thank you for joining us on Radio Times, coming in and talking about this all-important relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Anna Vieden, Program Coordinator of the University of Pennsylvania's Middle East Center. And we've got David Fahrenthold waiting in the wings. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, has been covering the Trump family and its business interests. Got a Pulitzer Prize for some of his reporting. And his most recent article has to do with the Trump family company and its relationship with Saudi Arabia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times.
Saudi Arabia, and I get along great with all of them. They buy apartments from me. They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much.
That was candidate Donald Trump at a rally in 2015 touting his business relationship with the Saudi regime and members of the royal family. Our guest, David Fahrenthold, covers the Trump family and its business interests for The Washington Post. In fact, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for national reporting. His latest article is about Donald Trump and the Trump Organization's ties to wealthy and well-connected Saudis, something we need to understand more as we learn about the fate of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who disappeared 2 weeks ago after entering the Saudi consulate in Turkey. David Fahrenthold joins us by phone, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
I just said goodbye to our guest who was talking about the longstanding relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, describing it as a transactional relationship for decades now. Is that even more so under President Trump?
Well, certainly the reliance on Saudi Arabia has been even more explicit under President Trump. And putting aside what we'll talk about in a moment, his personal business connections, his administration has given up a strategy that the Obama administration had, where they've tried to sort of balance between Saudi Arabia and other players in the region. They've gone all in on Saudi Arabia and on Israel, two traditional U.S. allies. And the sort of idea from the Trump administration has been, you know, the Saudis are key to everything. They're key to our foreign policy. They're key to our energy policy. You know, we can't go on without them.
Well, you write in this piece, Saudi Arabia is a political ally for President Trump and a customer. And then you go through a number of business transactions that really date back to the 1990s. How did the Saudis get involved with then businessman Donald Trump?
Well, it began as really sort of a one-sided relationship in the Saudis' favor. When Trump had his sort of debt-fueled crash in the early 1990s and he had all these assets he needed to get rid of, he was sort of a desperate seller. One particular Saudi prince bought a couple of the things that Trump was trying to get rid of. Trump had bought a yacht. He actually had originally bought the yacht from Adnan Khashoggi, the cousin of Jamal Khashoggi. But then Trump couldn't make the payments on the yacht, and he had to sell it to a guy named Prince Talal. Then later, Trump had bought the Plaza Hotel, the famous Plaza Hotel in New York, also could not make the payments on it, and that also was bought by a Saudi prince. So in the beginning, I don't want people to think that these were sort of the Saudis cultivating Donald Trump in 1990 because they knew he'd be president someday. These were guys who wanted these assets and saw Trump as kind of a weak man in the market who would sell at a low price.
A weak man in the market because at that time in the 1990s, what he was something, he meaning Donald Trump was what, $1 billion in debt or almost $1 billion?
I think he has said it was $900 million in debt. It was a huge amount. He had sort of gone through this spending spree in the early 1980s in Atlantic City and New York City, and it all came crashing down. He just barely avoided personal bankruptcy in the early 1990s.
So is it Saudis just seeing they saw a good bargain that they could get a yacht at a discount price?
That was, yes. I talked to folks who know Trump's finances really well from that period and said, yeah, this was – Trump was, you know, they took him, they saw him as somebody they could force to give him a good deal.
And in the 1990s, do we know how much money Saudis, if you added it all up, how much they spent buying Trump either properties or things?
Well, it was hundreds of millions, but you have to remember that wasn't money that went to Trump's pocket. Trump was hugely in debt to a number of creditors. So I think, in fact, many of the payments went directly to the creditors, although that did sort of save Trump from some of his obligations.
2001, Trump sold the 45th floor of Trump World Tower to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for something like $4.5 million. Was he dealing with the kingdom or with the wealthy, or is there a difference?
In this instance, we're talking about Trump World Tower, which is a building he built right by the United Nations. And yes, we're talking about the kingdom. He sold their mission to the United Nations, a series of apartments for, as you said, quite a bit of money.
Now, we played this clip of when President Trump was running for, or Donald Trump, I should say, running for the presidency, where he talks about how much he is in relation with Saudi Arabia. While he is running for president in 2015, is he also looking to establish some business deals with Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, that's what's really interesting, period. So Trump said yesterday on Twitter, I don't have any business dealings in Saudi Arabia. And that, as far as I know, is true now, but it wasn't true when he was a candidate. When he was a candidate, he started a bunch of LLCs in the U.S. that seemed aimed at building a hotel in Jeddah, which is the second biggest city in Saudi Arabia. They were all started in late 2015 when Trump was already a candidate, and then shut down in 2016 just after he was elected. Trump has said he never made any income off of those. He never assigned any value to them. And as far as I know, the hotel was not built or even sort of planned. The question there was, you know, who were his partners? Who were the people that were going to be the sort of local on the ground on that project? We don't really know anything about that project other than the names of these LLCs.
In fact, you write that there were 8 shell companies with the name Jeddah, and some had the word hotel in it. So that's evidence that he was at least looking to build, if not a hotel, some kind of hotel, series of hotels in Saudi Arabia?
That's right. So Trump in that period was in this sort of licensing phase of his career where people who were in various countries around the world would pay him to put his name on their hotel. You know, they were building a hotel in the country of Georgia or Azerbaijan or someplace like that. And Trump would agree to manage the hotel and get paid to market it and also to put his name on it. So if you look at the LLCs he set up for those projects we know about that got built or half built in Georgia or Azerbaijan, the naming conventions are the same as these hotel LLCs in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
But as far as you know, there's no hotel, Trump branded hotel in Saudi Arabia?
No, that never got off the ground. I would just love to know. The fact that he established these LLCs to me indicates that he likely signed an agreement with somebody. He had a local partner. He'd set up a revenue arrangement. There was at least sort of a deal on paper to do something there. And I'd love to know who his partners were in that place.
How would you find that out?
Well, we'd have to find the licensing agreement. You'd have to find some kind of paperwork. And it's not something that's in the public record. One of the most interesting projects of this period, sort of the same period of Trump's life, is the project he built in Azerbaijan, in Baku, Azerbaijan, which got built and but never opened, where Trump's partners were basically people who were laundering money for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And it seemed like in that case, which the New Yorker has documented really well, Trump, you know, knew or should have known that these were not the most upstanding investors he was dealing with and went ahead anyway. So it was not a period where it seems like he was applying a great deal of like moral scrutiny to the people he was working with. I'd just like to know who the people were in Saudi Arabia.
But it seems also that during this time period or relative time period that then candidate Trump was also looking to build a hotel in Moscow. Are there some parallels there?
Yes, I mean, the sort of I think the Moscow hotel, we know a little bit more about that deal, who he was trying to work with. But yes, those were places where he was trying to build. I mean, Trump was trying to spread his brand overseas, to places anywhere where he would get paid to put his name on something. And he was, as I said, not very scrupulous about who he was working with. So his candidacy sort of began at that time in his business career.
That's David Fahrenthold, and he is a Washington Post reporter. He covers the Trump family, its business interests, and as I mentioned earlier, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for his national reporting. And we're talking about a news story that he has in the Washington Post looking at then businessman or candidate Donald Trump's business relationships or proposed relationships with Saudi Arabia. Also want to talk about his hotels and the Saudis who have been staying at Trump-branded hotels here in the United States. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, you looked at Saudis who have stayed at Trump hotels since Donald Trump became president, so for almost the last 2 years. What have you found?
This is to me one of the most interesting parts of Trump's business relationship with the Saudi Arabians. Now we're talking about a period in which Trump continued to own his businesses, continued to draw revenue from them, even though he doesn't manage them day to day. So this is a case where, you know, the Saudis knew that they were putting money in the pocket of the president of the United States. And there's three instances that we know of where Saudi customers provided a boost to Trump's hotels. One in D.C., Trump's hotel right on Pennsylvania Avenue near the White House. The Saudi government's lobbyists, so this is the Saudi government's money directly, spent $270,000 to buy hotel rooms and food for people they were flying in to lobby Congress, basically to undo a bill they had passed under Obama that the Saudis didn't like.
In fact, it was a law related to September 11th.
Right. It was a law that basically allowed people who were victims or relatives of victims of September 11th terrorist attacks to sue Saudi Arabia. And if they allege that the Saudis had a role in planning or not stopping the 9/11 attacks. So the Saudis were flying in people to lobby basically for that law to be undone. It didn't work. The law is still on the books.
Right.
But they spent a lot of money at Trump's hotel in D.C. And the other two instances have to do with Trump's hotels in New York City and Chicago. These are hotels that have suffered a lot since Trump has become president. They've lost a lot of their traditional customer base, and Saudi customers have kind of cushioned the blow in those places. In New York, actually, we got a letter that the general manager of that hotel had sent out to his investors earlier this year, in which he said, you know, it's been two down years. Revenue's been down for a couple of years. But the first quarter of 2018 was better. It was up above the year before. And one of the main reasons was a single stay, one stay by a group of Saudis who were traveling with the crown prince who was visiting New York at the time. They spent enough money in their five-day stay that it basically saved our revenue for the entire quarter.
Hmm.
And then in Chicago, Trump's hotel there, the things that they've given to their investors show that the number of Saudis staying in the hotel has expanded very, very rapidly since Trump became president.
In fact, you included this in your story, looking at Saudi Arabia. This is the hotel management update, sales and marketing. 2016, 81, I guess, is it 81 bookings?
Yeah, they're room nights.
So they're room nights. Okay, room nights.
One room per night.
One room. And then 2017, 116. And then in 2018, 218. And, of course, we're not done with 2018 as well. But I should say that also Brazil, Italy, Canada, China, Great Britain, you do see an increase, although not quite as dramatic when it comes to those from people from those countries staying at this hotel in Chicago.
That's right. The Saudi numbers are still small as a fraction of the overall room nights. What's interesting is the increase. China being the other place that has a, you know, complicated geopolitical relationship with the U.S., but also saw an increase in rooms in Chicago.
Let me read some comments here. Facebook comment from Frank. What about the Trump family's business interests in Saudi Arabia? How much of Trump's policymaking is driven by conflicts between U.S. interests and his own? And David, that's sort of what your article looks at. Can we come to any kind of conclusion here? And it should be said that, Trump has been very much quoting from the Saudi Arabian crown prince and also the king of Saudi Arabia, defending the Saudi Arabian point of view as related to Khashoggi.
That's right. Trump has been extremely he's echoed what the Saudis have said, even as that story has changed. You know, the Saudis originally said, well, this journalist has been left out the back door. He came in our consul and then left. And then there's been sort of rumors about, you know, maybe it was rogue agents or rogue killers who did this. Trump along the way has, even as the Saudi story has changed, Trump has kind of parroted the Saudi story, the United States has a huge number of leverage points over the Saudis that don't go up to the point of us cutting off relations with them. And we don't seem to be willing to use any of those leverage. We're sort of acting like we don't have any leverage at all. But I think it would be a stretch to say that's because of Trump's personal business relationships. That certainly adds, you know, an extra conflict for him, but his entire Middle East policy is based on the Saudis being our close allies and the Saudis winning. And I don't think he's, you know, I don't think that's, you know, I think that's probably the most important factor with his personal business relationships in there, too.
That's David Farenthold from the Washington Post. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Something else, David, you write about in your article is, of course, this question about emoluments, the Constitution's ban on emoluments that a president can't accept any payment or emolument meaning salary or fee, office title from a foreign state king or prince. I know there are a couple of lawsuits related to this, but how do you see emoluments and Saudis staying at Trump hotels?
Well, this is exactly the kind of conflict the Emoluments Clause was written to protect against. I mean, the idea that the framers of the Constitution had when they wrote the Emoluments Clause was we would get to a place where that we would not know if the president was serving his own personal business interests or the country's interests. And to avoid that question even coming up, to avoid having, you know, sort of having to argue about that, they said, look, presidents can't take emoluments from foreign states. And all presidents until now, had sort of tried to stay, you know, far away from even, you know, putting their toe on the line. Jimmy Carter sold his peanut farm, as you recall, to make sure that he didn't have any business conflicts. So Trump is the first person to sort of go up to the line of, you know, what's an emolument. His question is not, he hasn't taken the approach of, well, I'm going to do everything I can to avoid the appearance of taking emoluments. His approach has been, look, I'm going to take these payments and I'm going to argue that they're not emoluments, because mm-hmm. what the Founding Fathers really meant to ban was not a president doing business with a foreign government, but rather a president just taking straight up bribes from a foreign government. Mm-hmm. And because these are business transactions and not bribes, his argument is they're acceptable. So he's involved in a couple of protracted court cases that so far the plaintiffs, people suing Trump, have succeeded in getting into court and beginning the process of suing him, at least to make him reveal the details of the foreign government's payments to his business.
Susie has a question related to that, David, saying, would we have any more information about Trump's relationship to the Saudis if we had his tax returns? Would we?
It's hard to know because I don't really know what's in Trump's tax returns, but we would certainly know a lot more about his businesses in general. I think it would make this question easier to evaluate. You know, one of the things they said they would do, the Trump administration, when they took office, was not release his tax returns, but to sort of donate what they said was all foreign profits to the Treasury, to give those profits to the U.S. Treasury. And the implication there was that at least we would know, you know, he didn't want to make profits from doing business with foreign governments, and he would tell us when he was. And so far, the process has been extremely not transparent. The Trump administration, the Trump organization, said at the end of 2017, look, we've donated $151,000 back to the Treasury as our foreign profits, but we won't tell you how that number was calculated, which countries that money came from, or really anything else other than the number itself.
Well, I hate to end our conversation there, but David Farenthold, we are out of time, and thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he covers the Trump family and its business interests for The Washington Post. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.